I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Imagine tossing 40% of the food in your fridge, your freezer, and your cupboards into the trash. That makes no sense on the face of it, but that's how much food goes uneaten here in the United States. But while that is wasteful and does raise questions about our eating habits, some see business opportunities, recycling those scraps and making them into compost and using new technology to turn rotting food into fuel. We're going to talk about that a bit later in the show, but first, expiration dates, you know, those sell-by, use-by labels on food. It turns out that most people think that food goes bad after that date. Not so, according to our guest. Emily Broad-Lieb is director of the Food Law and Policy Clinic at Harvard University, author of a new report titled The Dating Game, How Confusing Food Date Labels Lead to Food Waste in America. And Emily, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We have Emily?
Yes.
Okay, good. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Emily, when did those expiration labels begin to appear on food?
Well, I think the real sort of heyday of companies putting labels on food was really in the 70s. And if you think about the history of where we've been obtaining our food, that's around the time we started really relying on going to the supermarket. More and more Americans were off the farm and were buying things from a store and wanted indicators of freshness. So these dates came around because consumers were asking for ways to know that their food was fresh.
And who decided or who decides on an expiration date?
Well, that's a good question. I think what we found is many people think that, you know, like so many of the labels on our packages, that these are actually regulated. But in fact, it really is, there's no federal regulation on the dates, with the minor exception of infant formula, which requires a use-by date under federal law. So it's states sometimes require dates on different things, but mostly it's up to manufacturers to put those on and do, you know, decide when to use a label, what the label should say, and how that date is going to be set.
So what does that date mean?
Well, this is the big shocker. This
yeah, exactly.
Has, for the most part, nothing to do with safety at all. It's completely based on a manufacturer's best guess of the peak quality. So they're saying to you, on this date, we think that you will still have the top experience of this product. And that people knew that in the 70s, but over time we've really lost that knowledge. And people, as you said, a lot of people think it's safety. About 90% of people throw food away on that date because they're afraid that they're going to be sick if they eat it afterwards.
So if we're talking about quality, what we're talking about, just when something is at its peak freshness or peak taste value?
Yeah, exactly right. It's, you know, they're sort of guaranteeing that until that date, it's going to have all the things you expect. Your cracker is going to be just as crispy as you would want it, and, you know, your cereal won't be stale. And, you know, so again, it's just telling you that this is when it's going to be at the flavor that they have, that they've anticipated. And they really do those based on primarily consumer taste tests, or they use other methods like that. But again, it's very subjective. It's here's when the most people thought the food was still at its very best.
You also seem to be saying from your report that it's also aimed at retailers. And I'm assuming if consumers are tossing out this food, that retailers are probably doing the same thing?
That's a really good point. So I think two things to say. One is one of the biggest issues with dates, and one of our primary recommendations in the report, is that we should no longer use the sell-by date, because that was really intended to be a communication between the manufacturer and the retailer. And it was the manufacturer saying to the retailer, if you sell it by this date, when the customer gets it home, they'll still have a few days or a week that they will still have the peak quality of this. But again, you know, 90% of people are throwing things away on the sell-by date because they don't know what it means. So one of our key recommendations is, if you want to use a sell-by date, hide it from the consumer and really focus on dates on the food that are communicating with consumers and that they can understand. And industry has, in a series of reports, come out saying expiration dates are a huge driver of waste. In 1 year alone, industry found that $900 million worth of food was thrown away from the supply chain. And this is a huge amount of food that we're just tossing.
Well, when you said, you know, hide it from the consumer, I'm sure people listening in the audience, some of those consumers are saying, now, wait a minute. You know, I want all the information I possibly can have about my food.
That's a good point. I think we mean hide it from the consumer, not in the sense of hiding information, but just of swapping it out for a date that's more meaningful to consumers. So again, you know, if we think of consumers, we're not just wasting food and all the resources that went into producing that food, but we're wasting money. The average American household wastes about $1,500 a year on food that we throw away. So if everyone could waste a little bit less because the date that was on there was really more communicative, I think that people would benefit from that.
But until we get to that point, and those dates are on that food, what should we do with that information? Just ignore it?
Well, I think that's what's really tough. I mean, I think the first main thing is that we're hoping from this report that people are educating themselves and their families. You know, I think we find that the younger generations are really so vigilant about throwing food away on that date no matter what. And, you know, people from a generation or two generations ago are used to not having dates on every food and just tasting the food, you know, cutting off if there's a little bit of mold on cheese or something and still using it. So I think the main thing we want consumers to be to arm themselves with is knowledge that these dates are not a safety thing. There has not been a single instance of any foodborne illness or food poisoning that was caused by someone eating food after that date. So you can feel comfortable to taste the food, smell the food. If it doesn't taste the way that you want it to taste, then you can throw it away. But I think just tossing things on those dates is really what's causing all this trouble.
I mean, the sort of old-fashioned taste test. And I certainly have taken mold off of cheese and, you know, done scooped some of that mold off of yogurt as well.
Yeah.
What about coming up with some kind of more, I guess, universal system so that it's not state by state or company by company, but at least a date that has some consistency to it?
That's exactly where, you know, we sort of came out at the end of this was, you know, having rules state by state, having standards company by company, what the end result is that when we go into stores, we see some things have sell by, some say best before, right. Some say enjoy before. It's so confusing for people. What we really think makes the most sense is to have a coherent, reliable, and uniform system that is really standardized and unambiguous about the fact that for the majority of these foods, the date is linked with quality. And so we should just have one label that says, you know, peak quality before or best taste before. And then this way people can really read that and say, okay, this is a quality thing. I'm not going to get sick. And for the tiny handful of foods where there may be some safety reason, so we're talking about deli meats is probably the biggest offender where, you know, you probably, it's safer not to eat those, you know, after they've been in your refrigerator for a few days. We should have a different label for those. And there's no reason to hide the ball from consumers. It should be very clear to them so that they know this in this minor, you know, in this small group of foods, we really want to be careful about how long we have this sitting around.
You seem to also, having read your report, do like the idea of a freeze-by date. How come?
Well, I think, you know, people sort of have forgotten how to store foods and how to take good care of them. And I mean, I think that's just one piece of the puzzle. But many of these foods can be frozen on or before the date that's their peak quality date. So meats would be an example, but also a lot of fruits and vegetables. I mean, those don't typically have dates, but I think people forget that the freezer is a place where you can put some of those things and get them to last longer. So what we were thinking was on products where freezing the product is really appropriate and makes sense, reminding consumers of that so that they don't forget. I mean, even a loaf of bread, things like that. I mean, people leave them out on the counter and they go bad. And I think linked with that is just remembering keeping your people's refrigerator at the right temperature and putting things away that should go in the fridge, not leaving them out.
What got you interested in this? It seems like such an interesting sort of detail of our food market.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So our program, I mean, we work on issues sort of across the food system, and we take on clients like organizations, governments, individuals that are trying to improve outcomes in the food system. And we've been doing a lot of work around food access, food security, and sort of not thinking about the other side of it, which is part of the high cost of food is related to the fact that so much food is wasted and that companies have to charge more to account for all the waste that's you know, the 40% of food that's getting thrown away. So we got involved by actually working with Doug Rao, who is the former president of Trader Joe's and is launching a retail store that's going to sell food at or past its expiration date that's still safe. Hmm. We did some research, legal research for him to help him start his initiative, and we kind of fell into a gold mine of this information and thought, we have to get this message out there. Consumers really need to know this. And we were able to partner with the NRDC, who is very concerned around this issue as well.
Are companies afraid of lawsuits? I mean, as you said, there really have been no instances that you know of people getting, you know, poisoned for because something was out of date. But are companies afraid of things like that?
I think in the, you know, the big picture, they're very afraid of lawsuits. I don't know that how it plays out with regard to these dates, because I think, you know, what we really found in the end is that because the dates are so unclear, people aren't using them properly in either direction. So we've spoken most of this call about the waste, but the on the flip side of that, people sort of think the date is overly protective, so they'll kind of use food up until that date, whether or not they've stored it properly. If they left it out in a hot car, left it on the kitchen counter overnight, they'll say, oh, well, it hasn't passed the date, so I'm still going to be safe. So I think, in fact, you know, from a liability or risk point of view, I don't think that these dates are actually really protecting companies. And I think, you know, there could be some changes we would want that companies might resist because of that, but I don't think that these are particularly protective of them.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye, you mentioned the word food or the words food security. And it is interesting to think if we're throwing out 40% of the food or it goes uneaten, we also have this problem of food insecurity or even hunger in this country and the kind of mismatch there.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's really, you know, one of the issues that people keep overlooking, and if we could divert even, you know, some percentage of this waste, keep it in the food stream, keep people eating it a little bit longer, then we can really alleviate a lot of the hunger in this country. And you know, in terms of food security, about a sixth of Americans are food insecure, which means they are unable to, you know, have enough food to eat throughout the week and throughout the month at all times. So it's something that we're really concerned mm-hmm. about. I think the reason for food waste with expiration dates and with, you know, all the things you're going to talk about on the rest of this call, finding ways to use that food, keep it in the food stream, or use it productively if you can't, is really important for the environment and for food security and for the economic benefit of consumers that are wasting $1,500 a year on food that they throw away.
Well, Emily Broadlieb, thank you so much for getting our conversation started, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
You're welcome. She's director of the Food Law Policy Clinic at Harvard University, author of a new report called The Dating Game about food labels, expiration dates. And we have another guest waiting in the wings. We are talking about food and the fact that we throw so much of it away and what to do about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra and Rafael Frubeck de Burgos perform Debussy's incandescent seascape La Mer and Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe. Tickets are available at 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, La Mer and more with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We have the time on Radio Times to bring you in-depth discussions about the important issues of the day, whether here in the tri-state area, across the country, or from around the world. Like you, we're curious about everything, and that's why we cover everything on Radio Times. Make a pledge of support to ensure that this kind of radio service survives. That phone number, 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks.
Media Providence Friends School, located in downtown Media, supports WHYY. MPFS is hosting an open house for parents of children age 3 through grade 8 on Friday, November 1st at 9 a.m. Every day at MPFS, students from different backgrounds and faiths are encouraged to imagine, explore, question, and create while discovering joy in learning and acquiring the skills they'll need to make the world a better place. Details at mpfs.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Sounds crazy, but Americans throw out a lot of edible food. We just talked with Emily Broad-Lieb about the fact that those expiration dates really don't mean very much, and many people throw out a perfectly good food when they could actually eat it. We're going to be talking about changing food into compost and also finding out about how to use new technology to turn rotting food into fuel. Joining us now is Nelson Wydell, co-founder and partner in the Pennsylvania Compost Group and the Wilmington Organic Recycling Center. That's Wilmington, Delaware. And Nelson Wydell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. And to our listeners, any questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. I know your facility has been around, what, about 4 years or so?
The facility in Wilmington has been around for about 4 years.
Can you describe it to our listeners?
It's the largest food waste composting facility on the East Coast. It's in the city of Wilmington, and it's processing approximately 600 tons per day of food waste, that's being delivered from as far afield as Baltimore up to New York City.
I'm trying to imagine what 600 tons of food waste looks like. Is there any way to describe
it's like
that?
A huge pile.
Is that what it looks like? I'm sorry. Go ahead. When you look at that, I mean, what does it look like?
Well, food waste. Let's say from a supermarket, you'll see a fair amount of waxed cardboard, which is not recyclable, as is just regular cardboard. So that you'll see food, you'll see, you know, some soiled paper, and in the food there'll be, you know, lots of fruits, vegetables, cuttings, things like that. But from restaurants, it's a little bit more pure, mostly, you know, culls from preparing salads and things of that nature. But we take both pre- and post-consumer food waste, so that means that we're getting, you know, plate scrapings as well as food from the Philadelphia distribution center or from university cafeterias, prisons, schools, fast food restaurants, convenience stores, and wherever food is received, processed, or used, we get it from there.
And it's up and down, pretty much up and down the East Coast?
Well, pretty not all the way down, but that, as far as Baltimore, but all the way up to New York City.
And you are taking, as you say, these 600 tons of waste and what, turning it largely into compost? Is that the sort of end product?
The end product is compost, and our process is an aerobic process as opposed to what you're also going to be speaking of, which is making energy, which is anaerobic composting, so that we provide the right ingredients for the microbes, natural microbes that live everywhere, to thrive and reproduce, and they are like Pac-Man. They're busy, busy eating the food waste and turning it into body mass, which is humus, which is compost. And compost is the organic part of soil, and which is really life itself. It makes things grow, so that the compost has as many uses as things that grow do. So you can make topsoil, potting soil, different kinds of bedding mixes. Our compost has been blended in with the topsoil and used on Lincoln Financial Field, where the Eagles play.
Oh, sure.
At the Art Museum, Wawa's stores use it for their plantings out front. So anywhere things grow, compost helps.
And how long does it take to take a pile of food waste and turn it into compost? How long does that take?
Well, the active part of it, which is where the high heat, which is self-generated by the microbes, is about 8 weeks.
Wow.
But compost, to some degree, is like wine, so you want to age it beyond that. So I would say, all in all, 4 months or so from a rotten banana or tomato into a fine screen compost.
And I know San Francisco has decided that, I mean, they're going to basically pretty much end, I guess, sounds like end, you know, sending things like garbage to landfills. And it sounds like other cities are getting in on this as well, in part because of the cost. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, you need both, and you're right. San Francisco, I think now 2 years ago, mandated separation, not only commercial food waste, but also residential, to be separated and composted. And now, here on the East Coast, it's starting to grow in popularity. In fact, Princeton Township, New Jersey, and Lawrence Township, New Jersey, have both initiated food waste programs. And the city of New York is starting a 200-ton-per-day pilot. It's a big pilot.
Are they going to send it to you?
Well, we anticipate that we'll get some of it. There's a couple other composting facilities in Connecticut and New York that probably will get some, too. But, yes. So, yeah, we do see that it's now gaining in popularity. And it's not just the environmental part of it. The facility in Wilmington is the first and only composting facility on the East Coast, which is now registered on the Climate Action Reserve, which means that we're reducing greenhouse gases. And that's certified. So the environmental aspects of making a good, clean, natural product, reducing greenhouse gas, is wonderful. But it also has to be economic. And that's why we see the popularity gaining here in the Northeast, because the cost of disposing in a landfill or an incinerator is quite high versus the rest of the country, so that we can charge less than it costs to dispose in a landfill, less than it costs to dispose at an incinerator, as well as offer those environmental benefits.
You know, I noticed Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York talking about this program. He called what you do the kind of final frontier, I guess, when it comes to things like recycling. Do you see it that way?
Sure. You know, the traditional recycling of glass, plastic, metals, paper, cardboard has matured somewhat, you know, over the last, let's call it 20 years or so. And the biggest untapped part of the waste that's still going to a landfill that is recyclable are the organics.
Yeah.
And it's as much as 30 to 40% of what's going in a landfill is organic and should be composted. I mean, that's Mother Nature's way. And so that's true. It is the final frontier as far as recycling.
And how about the smell down there in your facility?
Well, you can't compost without generating some odor, and you try to mitigate that as much as you can. Technology that we use down there was developed by the Gore Company, which is famous for Gore-Tex, so that the piles are covered with a semi-permeable fabric, which controls the odors a great deal. But it does smell like, you know, mulch or compost, which is kind of similar to, I don't know, brewing or corn milling. And you have to stay on it all the time, because it's a natural process that does generate some odors.
And I know you're in the Port of Wilmington. Is there a residential neighborhood nearby? I'm just curious about whether you've had to deal with complaints at all, for instance.
Oh, yeah. We have to deal. We have a 24-hour odor hotline. We have an outreach program with the community. I guess we're probably a couple thousand feet from residential area.
Mm-hmm. Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Nelson Wydell, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He's co-founder and partner in the Peninsula Compost Group, also the Wilmington Organic Recycling Center. And as he has been describing to us, the facility gets about 600 tons of largely food waste, and turning that into compost. And it's part of our discussion today about the fact that we throw out a lot of food and we're trying to figure out what to do about it. We'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Nelson, tell us a little bit about Cooper. Who's Cooper?
Oh, well, one of the unpleasant surprises when we first opened up was being visited by several thousand seagulls that I guess have been residents for generations over at the landfill in Delaware, which is nearest. And although they couldn't actually get to the material we're composting because we keep it enclosed or undercover, they still made a big mess. So that we received all sorts of suggestions on what to do, including cannons,
oh, really?
Noisemakers, or professional falconer with a peregrine falcon to chase the birds, or even some guy came in and said, well, we ought to tape record seagulls being killed and broadcast this
oh,
over
dear.
Your site. Well,
oh, dear.
I didn't go for any of those.
I'm glad to hear that, Nelson.
I found Cooper in Canada, actually, and he's a trained border collie and trained to chase birds and loves to chase birds. So he's really kind of our mascot, but also a welcome friend and hard worker to keep the birds off the property.
And it works?
He works, absolutely. That's all he loves to do is just run around all the time chasing birds.
And have the seagulls learned that there's Cooper there to keep them away?
Yes, and, well, of course, they're always playing games with him. You know, they'll go down the end of the property, and then he'll go down there and chase them away. So he does a pretty good job.
But, you know, you have a unique perspective on what Americans do with their waste, and I wonder if you have advice for us. I mean, obviously, this is a business for you, and you're hopefully making some money off of this, but nonetheless, you see a lot of what we throw out.
Well, I was listening in earlier when you were speaking of outdated food. It's not unusual for us to get tractor trailer loads of food that looks perfectly acceptable, but it's either, you know, it's a little bit outdated. They might find a few, you know, spoiled whatever, tomatoes or whatever it might be, and reject the whole load. So that we do see, you know, quite a bit of waste that seems a shame, that looks like usable food. But of course, we also get the plate scrapings and things that are left over from, you know, the portions that, you know, someone might not want when they're eating at a diner or a restaurant or whatever. So you see it all.
Yeah. But I mean, does that make you, I mean, have you over the years become sort of more aware about what you throw out, you personally throw out?
Well, I grew up in a big family, so I was always trained to clean my plate. So, but yeah, we watch what we eat. We eat smaller portions and try not to overbuy things, you know. So I guess that's part of the training.
Right. Do you have to think about methane down there?
No, not at all. It's an aerobic process.
Right.
Meaning that we pump air into it, so there's no methane generation whatsoever. Methane is generated in anaerobic digestion, as you're also going to talk about, you know, to use that as an energy source.
And how did you get into this business?
Oh, boy. Well, I happened to be introduced to one of the true pioneers of composting back in the early 1980s. He was Swedish. His name was Erik Evason, and he started in the 1930s. And the guy actually changed my life in that, you know, I started back over 30 years ago in this business. And over the years, I've built 15 composting plants here in the United States and around the world. And I've been watching the evolution of the industry, meaning that now people are aware. 25 years ago, people couldn't even spell compost, but people are very aware of that now, and they're very aware of what they're doing and throwing away and recycling and all those sorts of things.
Well, it's kind of like a counterculture idea that really went is going mainstream.
It really is going mainstream. There's not a large corporation I'm aware of that doesn't have sustainability plans or green teams or efforts to reduce their carbon footprint, so that all of those things are finally happening after all these years.
You mentioned building plants in other countries. Do you find that other countries are ahead of the United States or behind the United States when it comes to composting things like food scraps?
Well, Europe has always been ahead of us as it relates to handling their waste. And, for example, recycling and composting, have been advanced there way before us. But there's other places, such as China, that are just starting to wake up and figure out they should do those kinds of things. So it depends, to the maturity of the regulations and laws and, you know, the consciousness of the population.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Cindy from Fox Chase joining us on Radio Times. And Cindy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I'd like to know what is the difference in the quality of your product in compost in comparison to the quality to the compost that people get from using earthworms. The problem with earthworms is that they're actually creating a major soil loss in forests and possibly other areas throughout the world.
Do you have, well, let me see what Nelson Wydell has to say. Can you answer Cindy's question?
Sure. She's speaking of a compost that would be made with vermiculture, which is, you know, large population of earthworms that are used to eat the food. And that can be done under controlled circumstances. And they make a very, very fine, very fine product. So I would say the difference is probably the quality, you know, as it relates to the constituents is pretty much the same. But that material, because it's being made by earthworms, is very, very, very fine in consistency.
Mm. Cindy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But do you see, and perhaps San Francisco, you know, generally ahead of the curve on a lot of these issues, that the sort of mandatory recycling of food scraps, do you see that on the horizon or coming our way?
I do. And it's not only San Francisco, it's Seattle, it's Portland, Oregon, it's Honolulu. The West Coast is ahead of the East Coast as it relates to these issues. But seeing what Princeton Township has been doing these last couple of years, they're saving money. Not only are they saving money, but they're, you know, it's a better environmental answer. Now, as I mentioned, Lawrence Township, New Jersey, and New York City are heading in that direction. And again, it's both. It's the environmental, it's better environmentally, but it also has to be economically feasible so that it's not additional cost to the generator of the waste. It has to be at least cost neutral or cost less money.
Are you making money?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a good business.
So what's on the horizon for you? I mean, this is an ever-evolving, ever-changing, probably technology. So what's the cutting edge today?
Well, the cutting edge, you know, I mean, you're always seeking, you know, I mean, Wilmington has taught us a lot of lessons because, you know, it was the first on the East Coast. So there's certain types of equipment for screening and those kinds of things that we're learning. But we're also developing new projects, one near Washington, D.C., because there's a huge pent-up demand for this kind of outlet and recycling facility for the Washington-Baltimore area. We're also developing projects in Connecticut and Massachusetts to do the same thing. And in fact, Connecticut and Massachusetts both have recently initiated mandates that will divert organic food waste from landfills when composting plants are available for the generator.
Taking it out of the landfill and taking it to a generator or composter.
Correct. So that's for composting, or it's for anaerobic digestion for creating energy.
Well, Nelson Wydell, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Co-founder, partner in the Peninsula Compost Group and Wilmington Organic Recycling Center. That's Wilmington, Delaware. We have another guest waiting in the wings talking about turning food scraps into energy. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Glenn Mead, an independent investment and wealth management firm for families, family offices, and endowments and foundations seeking thoughtful advice generation after generation. Details are available from Chip Wilson at 215-419-6100.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, October 29th through November 24th. The timeless love story of Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy comes to life on the BRT stage with a fast-paced and engaging adaptation by John Jory, filled with romance, laughter, and memorable characters. Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice has captivated generation after generation. Tickets at 215-785-0100 or brtstage.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. Today on the show, prison overcrowding in Delaware and innovative ways of turning garbage into energy and compost. Yes, you heard that right. We're in the middle of the membership campaign here at WHYY. Take a few minutes and become a supporter to ensure the future of this unique radio service. You decide what it's worth and then call 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY or pledge online at WHYY.org.
The Penn State SMEAL Executive MBA program in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Professors from the Penn State University Park campus teach in the weekend program at the ACE Conference Center in Lafayette Hill. Information at smealemba.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the fact that about 40% of the food in this country goes uneaten and what to do about it. Joining us now is Michael Weber. He's Deputy Director of the Energy Institute, Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. And Michael Weber, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And we began the hour in this hour of Radio Times just talking about the fact that we throw so much food away. And I'm still, to be honest with you, trying to get my mind around that. What are your thoughts? What does that tell you, I guess, about how we think about food, how we think about shopping?
Well, it's, I think it happens when food is cheap and it's not very expensive for most of us. And so it's something you can waste. We tend to waste things that are cheap, and we tend to treat more preciously things that are expensive. And food's relatively cheap. And that's kind of the consequence of successful food policy that's been in place for decades. Food didn't used to be cheap, and now it is. And that solves some problems in society, but it's introduced this other problem of waste. Now, what do we do with all the food we're throwing away that we could have eaten?
Well, and I was just talking to Nelson Wydell about using food scraps for composting, but we wanted to talk to you about how that can be turned into energy. And we spend a lot of time in this country thinking about things like light bulbs and other ways of being more energy efficient. But I wonder whether, you know, food scraps, frankly, gives us another opportunity to think about energy efficiency.
They do. One of the things that most people don't realize is how much energy is embedded in food. And it turns out about 10% of our national energy consumption each year is in the food system one way or another. And that includes the diesel for the tractors at the farm, and that includes the energy to make the fertilizers that grow the crops or the pumps that irrigate the crops, and then the energy to move the food, prepare it, heat it, boil it, cook it, and then take away the trash when we're done. That's 10%. So the amount of energy embedded in food is a pretty big number, much bigger than people anticipate. And it's bigger than lighting. You mentioned light bulbs. That's a great example.
Yeah.
Lighting nationwide is like 7% of our energy consumption is smaller than food. And we have all these policies pushing energy efficiency and lighting, but we could do the same thing for food. We could make our food system more energy efficient, or we could only make as much food as we need, not make so much extra food that we then throw away. And then the last point, I guess, is we could take the food we do throw away if we need to and turn it into energy. We can convert it into biogas, or we can burn it to make electricity. So there's a lot to think about there. There's a lot of energy in food, so we have an opportunity to reduce that and then harvest some of it at the end.
I want to pick up on all those ideas about what to do about it, but I'm thinking about just our sprawling food system. I mean, it just covers the country, whether it's farmers growing things or whether it's, you know, processing factories or supermarkets or individuals. It's sort of hard to imagine corralling, you know, that system that we have and trying to make it more efficient.
You could, so yeah, we have 5,000-mile salads, right, and fruits that are in season all year round because we'll bring them in from wherever they happen to be in season. So that's kind of amazing, right? That's a testament to man's ability to build complicated supply chains, and it has worked pretty effectively to bring good foods affordably to a lot of people. But it does sort of raise the question, okay, the supply chain that is global, how do we make it more efficient? And it seems like only putting as much water on the fields as you need for irrigation, no overpump. Only apply as much fertilizer as you need. Fertilizers are incredibly energy intensive to make. We make them from natural gas to make ammonia and other nitrogen-based fertilizers. Then we can make our trucks more efficient that move the food to our plates. We could only cook as much as we need. So there's all these things we do along the way, and each little step adds up. So there's an opportunity there, if we really put our minds to it, to make the food that we consume more efficiently, and then to only make as much as we need. The big thing here is, like, when we're wasting 25 to 50%, the number you said is 40%, that sounds about right. That's the food that is edible that we waste. And so that means we could just reduce how much we produce and make it match a little more closely to what we need. And that would save a lot of energy, too.
What do you think about, and this has been going on for some time now, the idea of growing corn for energy versus corn for food?
In America, we like corn. We have a big corn policy that pushes for biofuels. And those biofuels are supposed to come from corn-based ethanol to a certain volume of 15 billion gallons a year. And so now we find a significant fraction of our corn crop each year is going towards fueling our vehicles. And I think that's kind of amazing. And to some degree, it feels kind of preposterous. It invites this competition between food and fuel, or between food, feed, and fuel. And it rises prices for corn, which is good for corn growers, but it's not necessarily good for people who eat. So I think it's pretty tricky. I think our biofuels policy invites these moral dilemmas, and we don't have a good answer for it so far.
And let me just reintroduce you. That's Michael Weber, again, Deputy Director of the Energy Institute, Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, frankly looking for answers to the question about what do we do about all our wasted food. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michael, as you said, there are several ways, I guess, to get energy from food waste. One is through burning it. How does that work?
Well, the food we have is very rich in organic matter, and organic matter can be a fuel. Things like coal and natural gas and petroleum are also organic matter, and they have hydrocarbons in them, and they make great fuels. They burn, and they give us a lot of heat, and we can use that in effective ways. Well, the same kind of thing with biomatter that has this hydrocarbon content. So we can actually take our food one way, is burn it, and get heat and therefore electricity out of it. That's not necessarily the best option because food is very wet, so you spend a lot of heat of burning the food just to generate steam to dry the food out. But we could do it. That's one route. Another way that people do is with anaerobic digestion, where you put the food or the organic matter into what's called a digester, like a steel tank of sorts, and then microbes digest the food anaerobically, which means oxygen is not present. And when organic hydrocarbon matter breaks down anaerobically, it forms methane, or biogas that's comprised of methane and maybe a little bit of CO2.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that biogas is like natural gas. It's like a fuel. So you can use that in a fuel cell or a microturbine or a traditional engine or some other way to get heat, to heat our water or make electricity or just serve some of our energy loads. So you can take that food, you can burn it to make electricity or convert it to biogas to make electricity or some other heat form that might be more useful. Anyway, you look at it, you can get energy out of it. That's a pretty good opportunity, right? Once we've made our food system more efficient, once we've reduced how much food we throw away, we can still harvest energy out of the food we have to throw away. And there'll always be a little bit of food waste for sort of food security reasons and for health reasons. We don't want to eat spoiled food, for example. So we always have a little bit of food waste and capturing the energy, and it's probably a pretty good idea.
Well, and I guess it's a digester of some sort. I mean, it's creating a kind of a food power plant.
It's like a food, so there's two steps to it. One is the digestion. It's like a huge metal stomach is one way to think about it. You put this food into this metal stomach, and it breaks down the food just like our stomach does, and it makes this biogas out. Then the second step is to use that biogas, and you can use it just for heat. You can use it for cooking. You can use it to heat water for your house and your showers, or you could put it through a turbine or a fuel cell to make electricity. So the first step is to make the gas. Second step is to use the gas. But it works. We know it works. And there are farms that do it for manure, for example, with agricultural waste. And agricultural waste isn't that dramatically different than food waste, so you could do it with food waste as well. And for the farmers, it's a good deal because it removes an environmental liability, which is the manure. That's an environmental problem.
Right.
It solves that problem while reducing their energy bill. So it's one of these trade-offs. They spend money to get the capital equipment of the digester. They have to develop some know-how and expertise to maintain it. So those are two costs, the time and the money. But then they reduce how much money they need to spend on energy bills, and they solve the environmental liability problem. So it's a good news story.
But do you see this as, I mean, looking into the future, people having these digesters attached to their house, or do you see this as a neighborhood issue, a community, urban environments?
Well, there's three different ways we could do it. It could be each household or each family does their own equivalent of composting, but digestion instead. You're trying to get the gas instead of the soil amendments. Each family could have a little digester and a little fuel cell or something. That might be very expensive, and then you rely on people to master a technology that might be difficult to learn.
Sure.
And one of the challenges with this is because methane is such an active greenhouse gas, it has high global warming potential, you don't want to lose any of that methane. And so composting done badly or digestion done badly is bad for society, but composting done well and digestion done well is good for society. So you have to make sure we do it the right way. That's one way. Every home gets a digester.
Right.
Another way is grocery stores and other people who are part of the food distribution supply chain can maybe collect our food waste, or maybe our garbage haulers will do this. Get all the food waste into one central place and have one very large digester do it for us with a shared capital cost where we're all paying for that. A third way, depending on what city you're in, you can put the food down the drain. At least in Austin, Texas, where I am, our water utility that treats our wastewater, our sewage, they have digesters that they make, they use to make biogas. So for me, it's actually probably easier for me to put my orange rinds and banana peels and organic waste down the drain through the disposal. It grinds it up. It sends it down the sewer pipes to the wastewater facility, and they turn it into biogas much more efficiently and cheaply than I could. And not every city has that, but maybe every city should. And so that's an opportunity. So maybe we'll do it at our homes. Maybe garbage haulers or grocery stores will pick up our food waste for us and do it. Or maybe our wastewater facilities will do it for us. So there are a couple of different options. We'll see which one wins out in the end.
Well, it's interesting. Let me see what Max from, looks like Collegeville, Pennsylvania, has to say. And Max, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about distilling your own feedstock from various, like, sugar beets, or if you grow corn at your house. I know right now it's really difficult to sort of get the legal go-ahead to do that, to make moonshine, essentially, for either for heating or for your vehicle. I was wondering what the speaker would had to add to that, or if we could discuss that.
Oh, well, sure. And Michael Weber,
sure.
you were talking about what's going on in Austin. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so biofuels, for the most part in America, when we mean biofuels, what we mean is ethanol or methanol, different alcohols that we can burn. Alcohols are pretty good fuel. There are all sorts of movies where there's a bar fight and someone spills alcohol and it catches on fire. That's because alcohol likes to burn.
Yes.
It's a good fuel. And you can make that alcohol from things like sugar and sugar beets and other things where you ferment it and you create alcohol. And then you can make it from corn to make ethanol. And there's all sorts of illegal distilleries that have occurred over the 100 years or so, or longer, I guess, for all of human history to make alcohol. So it's possible to make alcohol at home, which means it's possible for you to make fuels at home. And you can do it with whatever sort of food scraps or whatever materials you have. The sugars tend to be the easiest. They ferment the easiest alcohol, like sugar or sugar beets. And that's sort of the way Brazil does it. They use sugar cane to make ethanol. You can also use corn or starches, but then you have to go from starches, break them down to sugars, and then do the fermentation. And basically any form you want will work as a fuel. That does put you at risk of getting sideways with the law, because I think our society doesn't necessarily want everyone having their own alcohol manufacturing plant in their backyard, because there are other societal downsides to that. And that's a trick. And I really don't know what the public policy outcome will be, but right now it's difficult to set up your own still and make it moonshine, even if you plan to burn it instead of drink it. I think that's just part of the evolving discussion.
Max, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, you're listening to Radio Times. Our guest, Michael Weber, the third in three guests in this hour of Radio Times from the University of Texas at Austin. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Mike, I'm just curious whether do you see the sort of end of landfills or even the reduction of landfills? And I ask that only because Nelson Wydell, our second guest, was talking about literally taking garbage out of landfills and turning it into compost.
Yeah, this is an interesting question. Is it the end of landfills? Well, no, not yet, because we still have a lot of cheap land in the United States. But it could be the end of landfills in Europe and Japan. And it could be the end of landfills on the East Coast in the United States, where it's just too expensive to find enough land to make a suitable landfill. So we're finding some land constraints. We're bumping up against some land constraints with landfills in different places in the world. And it sort of raises an interesting question. Well, if we have all this waste, we can't landfill, what should we do? Well, it turns out we can do the things we probably should have done anyway, which is reduce, reuse, recycle, all that kind of thing. Find some value in these waste streams and harvest them, harness the energy content, and put them to work. So right now, landfills, you put a bunch of trash in, the organic matter breaks down into methane. The landfill is like a huge anaerobic digester. It creates landfill gas that you can mine for. You poke holes in it, you extract the gas, and then you've got gas you can use. You can also mine the landfill for precious metals and other materials. But you can also divert the materials on the way to landfill. Instead of putting them in the ground, put them to use. Reduce the volume of landfill material dramatically by getting the remaining value of the materials into work in society. So I think that we're going to see landfills be become a less typical option as land gets more expensive and technologies to harness those materials become more cost effective.
Do you see, though, are we at a turning point, perhaps a slow turning point, when it comes to finding alternative fuels, sources of fuel?
I think we started to turn about 5 years ago. We got another 5 years ago with this transition where we got a new way of thinking about energy. We're looking to harness our waste streams. We're looking to reduce how much energy we use. We're looking to reduce our resources overall. We're looking to consume less stuff and generate less waste and less trash. So I think our philosophy has changed as a country, and our mindset is changing right now, which is pretty exciting to see. And I think people are moving towards resource efficiency and resource productivity, getting as much as possible out of every resource as they can. And I think that's a good thing because that will reduce environmental impact. It will also trigger a lot of innovation. And I think part of that is going to be evolving as prices shift. High prices for traditional energy forms and commodities will drive a lot of this innovation, a lot of this shift. Mm. And as long as prices stay high for some forms of energy, we're going to be clever and creative and try to find other options.
Almost out of time here, but are we getting over the kind of ew factor? We think about trash, we think about, you know, garbage, and there's the kind of disgust response. Are we getting over that?
I think we're getting over that. The way I see it is waste is what you have when you run out of imagination. There's always one more thing you can do with it. And so I think we're getting over it. As prices are high, we'll figure out how to cope. But yeah, I think we're changing our mindset for sure.
Well, Michael Weber, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I really appreciate it.
No problem. And he's Deputy Director of the Energy Institute, also Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Facebook, Twitter, archives, podcasts, Sirius Satellite Radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.